The following Dominican University of California production has been brought to you by radio.dominican.edu.
Thank you all so much for being here. I'm Elaine Petricelli from Book Passage. And God, I love you. And I have the pleasure of working with my colleagues and Dr. Denise Lucy, the founder and director of the Institute for Leadership Studies here at Dominican, on this lecture series and this amazing 10th year that we're celebrating today and this whole year. I do want to remind you that if you have a camera with you, it is very important, out of respect for Dr. Goodall and her vision, no flash for anybody. So please don't do any flash pictures. Also, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off right now. The lecture is being videoed by a professional videographer, so you will be able to find it in a few days online at dominican.edu. or at bookpassage.com. And so all of your friends who are very upset because they couldn't get tickets, you can calm them down and tell them they can watch the video soon. I'd also like to remind you that on April 30th, a book that is a perfect one to have after today's book, Novella Carpenter will be here to celebrate the One Book, One Marin choice of her marvelous book about gardening in Oakland. She will be in conversation with Dr. Michael Krasny. That's April 30th at 7 o'clock. And on May 10th, Senator Elizabeth Warren will be here. But here's the problem. We advertised it at 7 o'clock. If you're holding a Book Passage newsletter, which I hope you are, it tells you proudly that she's coming at 7 o'clock on May 10th. Bill and I changed plans to go to Europe just so we can be here. I'm not missing that, except that her publisher called us a couple of days ago and said, oh, by the way, we need to change it to 4 o'clock. So don't come at the wrong time. Be sure you come at 4. And you do need tickets for that. So get them early because, like today, it will sell out. The title of the book, which is included, is A Fighting Chance, which I love. So there's one other thing I have to tell you, and I don't want Dr. Goodall to hear it. As you know, we're all celebrating her 80th birthday. And some wonderful person has baked her a cake. So although we're going to talk about her birthday in the introduction, and we're going to talk about it perhaps in the conversation, at the end of the time, when you and the audience are asking questions, we are going to surprise her with a cake, and I hope we'll all sing happy birthday. And my friend Liz Chiarella will be bringing it out. She manages these events for Dominican, and she knows how to sing, so she'll be giving us the first note. So thank you all so much. We'll be starting with the introductions in just a second. Thanks.
We are here, we're seated, we're happy, right? And we're parked. That's why we're really happy. My name is Denise Lucy, and I am a professor of business and the director of our Institute for Leadership Studies and the proud partner of Book Passage of Corte Madera in San Francisco. Because of that partnership and their friendships with Hachette Publishers, we have this chance of a lifetime to welcome Dr. Jane Goodall to Marin County. And I'm proud to say that our Institute for Leadership Studies is in the newly named Andrew P. Borowski School of Business. And our leadership programs support all the majors and all the disciplines because leadership happens everywhere. And we are so thrilled to feature these lectures that are brought to us by Private Ocean Wealth Management and their support. Has anyone heard of Private Ocean Wealth Management? Yes, let's hear it. And they have been helping us for 3 years, which has helped us to expand this program. We've had a dozen lectures this year. And on May 10th, we have Elizabeth Warren also joining us. I hope you will consider joining us that day as well. And Private Ocean Wealth Management has been named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisor firms in the nation. And it's just thrilling that they're in our community, that they care about community, and then we have their support. Please thank Private Ocean Wealth Management for me. And I just have to just take another quick moment to recognize really important supporters. The Marin Women's Commission is here today, and each year they also sponsor one of our lectures to really match their vision and their mission of their organization. And it's thrilling to me to say that this is our 9th year that our Institute for Leadership Studies has partnered with the Women's Commission on many different training and development programs for women and girls in our community. And I'd like to recognize Cecilia Zamora, who's just received 2 great honors for her work in women's commissions, both here in Marin and nationally. Congratulations, Cecilia. Two more really cool things. We have so many Dominican sisters here today. Let's hear it for the Dominican sisters. The sisters have been in California for 150 years, and they are the heartthrob of our campus. We love you. Thank you for making us community-focused. Yes, let's thank them again. All right. So please join me in introducing, I'll introduce to you Richard Stone, and join me in welcoming him. He is the chairman and co-founder of Private Ocean Wealth Management. And he's also a trustee of here at Dominican University of California. He's practiced for 40 years in the field of financial wealth management planning, and he has received the prestigious Charles Schwab Impact Leadership Award for lifetime contributions, among many other awards. And it is my honor to welcome to you Richard Stone.
We are very fortunate today to have such a wonderful presentation. In 1960, Dr. Goodall began her landmark study of chimpanzee behavior in what is now Tanzania. Her work at Gombe Stream became the foundation of future primatological research and redefined the relationship between humans and animals. In 1977, Dr. Goodall established the Jane Goodall Institute, which continues the Gombe research and is a global leader in the effort to protect chimpanzees and their habitats. Dr. Goodall founded Roots and Shoots with a group of Tanzanian students in 1991. Today, Roots and Shoots connects hundreds of thousands of youth in over 120 countries who take action to make the world a better place for people, animals, and the environment. Recognition and honors for her amazing work include the French Legion of Honor, the Medal of Tanzania, the Japanese prestigious Kyoto Prize, appointed United Nations Messenger of Peace, named a Dame of the British Empire. Dr. Goodall travels and tours 300 days a year, continuing her mission to make the world a better place. And today, she came from one meeting, she is here, and she's off to UC Berkeley for a lecture this evening. One of Dr. Goodall's key projects is to finish the preparation of 3 pristine islands in the Kuili River for the transfer of more than 100 chimpanzees currently living in crowded conditions at JGI's Chimpunga Sanctuary. Today, Dr. Goodall will be joined on stage on conversations with Gail Hudson, who has written extensively about human development and our calling to create more conscious and loving relationships with ourselves. She has co-authored several books with Dr. Goodall. Yesterday was Dr. Goodall's 80th birthday. Let's help make her this best birthday by supporting her Coulee River project. Please welcome to the stage Dr. Jane Goodall and Gail Hudson.
Thank you all, and especially thank you to Gail Hudson and Dr. Goodall for being with us today. I'm going to be asking some questions through the event today, and then we'll have some opportunities for the audience to ask some questions too. There's a book that we sell at Book Passage that children and adults love called Me, Jane. And it has a surprise ending because this beautiful little girl who loves nature and dreams of going to where the animals she has been loving are turns out to be none other than you, Dr. Goodall. I want to thank you for that book, which won the Caldecott Medal. But in addition, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your childhood at the Birches and how that influenced where we are today.
Well, I was very lucky to be able to grow up in a house with a big garden. We had very little money, but it was my grandmother's house. And in this big garden, there were trees that I could climb. It was never very manicured, but it was perfect for a child. And in that garden is where I watch birds and insects and really got a love and a grounding in the natural world. And of course, there was my dog, Rusty, who taught me all about animals and how animals have personalities, minds, and feelings, just like we do. And today, we know that that's true of all kinds of other animals, that they have intellectual abilities, which were just thought to be impossible when I was young.
And, excuse my cough. And your parents and your grandmother, did they understand where you were going with all this?
Sorry, why don't you cough? Have a good cough, because I couldn't.
I was fascinated with your whole family, your grandmother and your aunts, and it seemed that they all came together to give you this love of nature.
Yeah, well, you know, when the war broke out, I was about 5 years old. And my father had rented a house in France, again with a big garden. He wanted us to grow up speaking French, but the war broke out. We'd only been there, I don't know, 3 months, so that didn't work out. And that's when we went to stay with my grandmother. And, well, I suppose the entire family, first of all, they all believed that me and my sister could do anything we want, even though I wanted to go and live in Africa, which was not possible for girls in those days, and everybody else laughed at me. And the family always supported me and said, if you really want something, you're going to have to work hard, but you must never give up and you will find a way. So, yes, my childhood was amazing.
I was fascinated with the fact that when you first went to Africa, you were not allowed to go alone, that you had to bring your mother.
When I first went, I saved up money to go and stay with a school friend who'd invited me to Kenya. And on that trip, I was completely alone. And that's when I met Louis Leakey. And he's the one who suggested I should study chimpanzees. Well, it took a year to get the money. Because again, I had no degree. We couldn't afford university. And Africa was the dark continent, it was very far away. And as I've said, I was a girl. That's when people laughed at me. But finally, we got the money from a wealthy American businessman. And then the second problem, back then what's Tanzania today was Tanganyika. It was part of the British colonial crumbling empire. And so the authorities said, a young girl on her own in the forest, we will not take responsibility for that. And in the end, they said, oh, well, if she has a companion. So it was my mother who volunteered to come. She came for 4 of those months. And it was really sad that she left just before the breakthrough observation. She did a fantastic job in boosting my morale, because in the early days the chimpanzees ran away every time they saw me. They hadn't seen a white ape before, which is what I was. And so when I'd get back, you know, worried that the money would run out before I'd seen something exciting, and that would be the end. And she was the one saying, but Jane, up on that peak, you are learning all kinds of things about the social structure, how they make nests at night, and what they were eating. And I was collecting, right from the beginning, the food plants. And my mother was helping by pressing them, and then we sent them off whenever possible to the Natural History Museum in Nairobi to have them identified. And anyway, she left just before I saw tool using and tool making, which was sad, but after that, the National Geographic came in.
All of the mothers in the audience, including me, now we have quite a standard to reach. Gail and Jane, this book, Seeds of Hope, is both extremely informative, but it's also very exciting. And I will tell you that there were times I cried in this book as I thought of the individual trees who were murdered, really. But I was very much moved by the plant hunters, these pioneers who went out and found the plants. And the research must have been quite overwhelming to find them. Could you talk a little bit about these amazing people who put up with all kinds of things?
Well, what I remember is that Jane called me one day and said, Gail, I've just discovered this amazing thing we have to put in the book. And she started going on and on about these plant hunters. And my initial thought was, oh no, more things in the book. Oh no. But then I realized that these plant hunters were like Jane. I mean, they were these adventurers that went off into these unknown places, risked literally life and limb to bring back plants to study into the more civilized world. They were fascinating, they were crazy, they were bold, but our gardens and our beautiful parks and the world is just, the plant world is completely altered and changed because of what they brought back and shared with all of us.
I was fascinated with some of these individuals. I don't know about anybody else, but botany always seemed like a pretty calm science to me when I was studying it in college. And I had no idea how dangerous botany could be. And I became quite fascinated with the gentleman who was called the crazed botanist. I thought that was pretty amazing, but also the woman he loved. I think his name is Philbert Cormoran. Can you talk a little bit about him? Because I'm enjoying knowing him.
Jane's saying, I have to tell this one. I was enchanted by the love story. So that was one that I particularly liked. So I wish I had a copy of the book so I could remember everything. But what I do remember is that, no, I'm not going to read. No, what I do remember is that her name was Jean Barre, I believe. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly. And Philip Commerson was a esteemed botanist in France and very educated in the academic world. And he fell in love with a woman named Jean Barre who knew her plants as women often did through her mother and her mother, and it was a folk wisdom. And he thought that she was so wise and so impressed with all that she knew that he brought her into his partnership as his colleague and then eventually as his lover, supposedly. And he was so attached to her and so in love with her that he insisted that she disguise herself as a man so that she could travel with him on these expedition ships, because at the time women weren't allowed to travel on these. And so I thought that was very romantic, and she pulled it off for a while.
The other thing that really impressed me about these plant hunters, as the two of you described them, is how it seemed to start with this man named Linnaeus, and then he taught John Burton, who taught Filbert Comestron, I'll never know how to say that, and then it goes to Joseph Banks, which is not the clothing people. It is someone who was, on a ship with Captain Cook. Am I correct on that? And saw some pretty amazing and awful, as well as marvelous things. And then we ran into someone who actually saw human sacrifice, David Nelson. And it seemed that each one handed it off to the next one, to Francis Mason, and then David Douglas, for which I believe, am I correct, that the Douglas fir, among other plants, or what he discovered. And it made me think of what you're doing now, and all of the young people. And I know that in our audience here, I met a young lady who is eight, and I know that we have people from Hall Middle School, and we have university students and postdocs here. So we have students who are studying your work and fascinated with it, but I'm fascinated with the Roots and Shoots group, who are doing so much. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that started and what is happening with it today.
Well, the reason that Roots and Shoots started back in 1991 is because by that time I was no longer living at Gombe with the chimpanzees, because I'd realized that right across Africa, forests were disappearing, chimpanzee numbers were decreasing. And so I was traveling first in Africa, realizing that many of Africa's problems that faced the people were due to the after effects of colonialism, where white people went into poor African villages and took natural resources, including slaves. And today, to some extent, some of the big multinationals are doing much the same. They're just taking the minerals and the timber and so forth, usually leaving Africans poorer. So that's when I began thinking I needed to travel around and talk about these things in Europe, in North America, then increasingly Asia and Latin America. And as I was doing all this traveling and talking, like, to groups of people like you, I kept meeting young people who seemed not to have much hope for the future. And most of them were just apathetic. Some of them were depressed, some of them were violent, even angry. And when I asked about it, they said, "We feel this way because we feel you've compromised our future, and there's nothing we can do about it." And we have compromised their future. You probably hear us saying, think globally, act locally. But if you actually spend time thinking about the problems that the planet faces environmentally and socially around the globe, you honestly don't have any energy left to act locally. But if you start with the little piece near you, where there's a dirty stream, or where there's some poverty that you can help to alleviate, where there are old people abandoned by their families, who can be cheered up with a visit, where there are stray dogs, whatever it happens to be, you and your friends can get together and make a difference there. And the idea from the beginning was, if you make a difference here in your little spot, and you know that people around the world, like you, are making a difference in their little spot, that will give you some hope for the future. We can do it if we get together. So what began with 12 high school students in Tanzania is now in 136 countries, and we have something like 1,500 active groups, and a group can be a whole school. So Lauren, who's one of our Roots and Shoots youth leaders, is somewhere here. Just wave, Lauren. There she is over there. And so every group of Roots and Shoots chooses three projects to make the world better, one for people, one for animals, one for the environment. The main message is every single one of us makes a difference every single day, and we cannot live through a day without impacting the world around us. And it fits very well into the theme of this book, because Hundreds of groups are planting trees. Hundreds of children are creating organic vegetable gardens. Hundreds and thousands of children are learning about feeling the earth and about the joy and the psychological benefit of being out in nature. And so we've actually put together a little video which gives a feeling of roots and shoots. If we can put these bright lights off and see it better, it would be a very nice thing to show.
Can we get the light?
Yeah, maybe they got some good ideas. Hi.
This is the brook. Hey.
Lazara, yes? Hey. After 20 years?
Yeah, they look the same, man. Huh? Excellent. Terrible.
I wish I did, really. Well, I think I know you.
From the very first moment that I left Gombe to try and raise awareness, I knew that I wanted to do something with youth, with children, that it was terribly important to get them to understand while they were still young. And so the idea was sort of going around in my mind, and I was talking at schools on my lecture tours and meeting people who worked with kids. And then having this group here on this veranda in 1991, really cemented everything.
You're a good alumni.
You don't disappear.
And I always demand this is Amina.
I'm glad there's you two young ones here with all the alumni.
And finally, that led to this global program that we call Roots and Shoots.
She came to my school and she was doing this lecture, and so she was talking about all about the chimpanzee in Gombe, the animal feelings and the human community and the environment, and trying to really tell about the role of young people. And the powerful message is when she was telling about like animals can feel the pain, is how human beings can feel the pain. It was that last year, we just gathered all together, Roots and Shoots members from different parts of the world. And it was something very unique to see a young boy from Palestine and someone from Israel, all of them coming together, sitting at the same table, discussing all about peace and how and what they can do to help to make the peace in their areas, even starting Roots and Shoots clubs in the Israel and Palestine and bringing these young people all together.
It brings me so much joy to realize that what we started here almost 20 years ago is now spread to over 100 countries globally.
Some people think it's far away. Some know it's with them every day. You are the reason we found out. So thank you, Star. There are no winds that can blow. When they try to blow it away, is when you know we will always be there. To some, it's the strength to be a part.
Hello.
To some, it's a feeling in the heart. And when you're out there on your own, it's the way back home.
So
brings up one of my favorite parts of this book about agroecology and all that this, a word I had never heard of before, but makes so much sense. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that's happening and also urban farming. I saw in the video urban farming, but I was particularly moved about what is going on in Detroit, for example. Every time we hear the news, it's, oh, Detroit, poor Detroit, Detroit's a lost cause. And then I read your book. Tell us about it.
Well, I was very fascinated. I went to Detroit, I can't remember how many years ago, and everybody said, you know, this is a place that has suffered terribly because of the recession and the closing of the car factories and so forth. And it's, as you say, a lost cause. And then I read an article saying that these people had got together, and there was all these closed buildings and empty spaces, and they thought, well, we have no, there's not much, industry here, so let's use these spaces to grow food and to make it beautiful and to put trees. And more people got together, and there were tax breakthroughs for people who were actually growing food in the city. And it's changed completely. So I was back there a little while ago, and indeed, it's very different feeling now because there is so much green space, and I suppose industry will come back in soon and chop it all down again. But maybe there'll be enough young people with our roots and shoots to stop that happening. Mm-hmm. And I should say that when Roots and Shoots first came over to the U.S., which was 1995. One of the people who two of the people who helped to make it grow, right here in this area, which is Paul Case and Maureen Marshall, who are somewhere, there they are, over there. And so thank you, Paul and Maureen, for bringing it to California.
That brings me to what I never thought 10 years ago was going to be a very controversial subject, and that is seeds. As we find more and more GMO in our food and hear about seeds being controlled, and then I read in your book about a seed being found from a 2,000-year-old tree from Masada, and how important all of this is. So I would love for you to tell us about the work going on with seeds.
Yes, well, seeds, of course, are, you know, the seeds of life. Without seeds, we won't have plants, just as without bees, we won't have pollination, and the whole world will crumble away. But this date palm seed that you mentioned, 2,000 years, it was carbon dated, and I've met the woman who grew it back into life from Israel, and she's in the book. And then, of course, you've got now these seed banks and the Millennium Seed Bank in London, where mm-hmm. I spent quite a bit of time going and looking at all. And seeds are so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe some of the photography of seeds, which we have some of them in this book. And then, of course, the big problem is when seeds are patented, like Monsanto has all these seeds, and the farmers sometimes can no longer save seed from the crop as they've done for hundreds and hundreds of years. The seeds won't grow, and even if they grow them, they'll be sued because Monsanto has patented them. And some of the seeds actually, I'm not sure, I think they withdrew the Terminator seeds, but they've actually created seeds that won't grow. And so it's really harming farmers in the developing world that they have to, every year, buy the seeds all over again from Monsanto.
It should be, yes. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do about it, but we have to do something. But the Millennium Seed Bank, what a place that is. How many species of seed do they have right now?
Hundreds and hundreds. I can't remember. Can you, Gail?
as soon as we throw out a number, we'll have it wrong. But
right.
I can look it up. I have a book.
I think the book says 30,000, but that was last year, of course.
Yeah, and they're going on as long as they have funding. They want to collect more and
I'll
more.
Look it up.
And, you know, starting on. And then there's the big seed bank in Norway, in the mountain, that's been created for agricultural seeds of agricultural foods.
And one of the other things I found fascinating about plants in this book, we've heard about the tulip mania. I think it was the Bitcoin of its time. You all know how I feel about that, don't you? But I was also fascinated with what goes on with orchids. We think of orchids as such a lovely plant. I know it grows in many places. What is going on with orchid thieves?
Well, orchids have become so popular, and the big problem is that people are going out to where some of these rare species are found, they're still being found, and they just take everything. And it means that some of these orchids are highly, highly endangered. But of course, the hybrids are being made all the time, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And there are the two kinds of plant hunters, and we still have them today. And there are those who are the botanical plant hunters, and they go out because they're seeking knowledge. And then there are the commercial ones. And a lot of the botanical ones actually were paid for by people who really wanted to make money out of selling rare plants.
Mm-hmm.
And this caused terrible, terrible harm, and it still is today. I don't know, do you want to add something, Gail, to the orchid?
Well, what's so sad is when a plant is stolen for its beauty and then destroyed for its beauty. It's such a sad thing that humanity would be so confused as to pillage something in its love for it.
And we've come to respect plants as medicine. And I know that many people around the world carefully used plants. But I was reading in the book about people coming and taking too much, so they killed the plant. And it seems to me it should be illegal, but how do you make that illegal? Could you talk a little bit about how bioscience, I know we have a great biology department here at Dominican, but I'm concerned about how medicinal plants are becoming patented. I don't understand how that works.
Well,
no one wants to talk about it. It's scary.
Well, I think it's the same. I mean, you know, you can apparently patent almost anything if you
apparently
apply right. And I've always been utterly shocked that you could patent life. It doesn't seem right to me. And yet that can be done. In fact, somebody the other day actually put in a hole, and this went to court. They wanted to patent a chimpanzee. So next it will be a human being. And it's very, very scary, all of this patenting and the you know, when you create a genetically modified plant, you have to insert the genes from another creature, sometimes like jellyfish genes or monkey genes. I mean, it's very strange. And there is no precise science. It's guesswork, and there can be unexpected results from it, which can lead to various forms of allergens and things like that. So it's a really imprecise science, and yet the proponents will always talk as though it's a very precise science and that we can predict exactly, and this is the way to feed the world. And from everything I've read about this agriculture you were talking about, and most of the people who seem to really, really understand plants are saying the way to feed the world is through small-scale family farming, to do away with monocultures, to stop destroying the soil with chemical fertilizers, to stop poisoning our food with chemical pesticides and herbicides.
I loved the part in the book about the canopy and what goes on so far above us, the
whole world that we never see. Could you talk to us a little bit about that and how, what work is being done to save the canopy for the future?
Well, the person who pioneered this research in the canopy is known as Canopy Meg. I can't remember her proper name, but Canopy Meg is what everybody knows her by. What's her name? Bowman, that's right. Megan Bowman. And she started in Australia. And to get right up there in the tops of the trees, you know, the last time I did that was actually in a crane. And I went up in a basket in a crane above some of the canopy in Panama. And it's a completely different world up there. The whole creatures spend their whole lives up there. Various insects, a lot of plants are growing up there. And Canopy Meg was the one who pioneered the study of the canopy. Now you get these walkways through the canopy. It is a whole new world.
What a fascinating...
The reason that a lot of these plants are growing up there is because down on the forest floor, they're starved. They can't get light. They can't do photosynthesis. So they've, if you want to be unscientific, we say cunningly, they found a way of getting photosynthesis by riding on the top branches of these big trees.
Could you talk a little bit about fire, too? Because we all fear forest fires. And yet, as I read your book, I learned about certain seeds that germinate only when there's fire. It's just, I don't think forest fires are to be encouraged, but it... fire and fire. Germination seeds of seeds.
This is really interesting. And it took people quite a long time to realize that some certain plants, only when their seed goes through fire, and it can't be too hot, but it has to be pretty hot, like a typical grass fire, only then will they germinate. And there's a whole lot of fascinating science in there about this one particular plant who actually won't germinate unless the rain comes down through the smoke of a fire, and it's this special mixture of fire, smoke, and water. And so they're now creating this in the botanical gardens and using it to make those plants grow. It is really fascinating.
It is, because it all sounds so... It's so many things we've learned we need to rethink, and that's part of the beauty of this book, is that it makes us rethink. I was also really fascinated with the, you know, we think about when a forest is destroyed and we miss the forest, but the entire world being affected and how the animals actually germinate, have such a major part in germinating the seeds. So can you talk a little bit about poop?
Jane's going, I do that one. No. I'm not going to handle it completely. I am going to hand it off to Jane, but this was one of my favorite stories because it did bring in her observations in Gombe and how those little seeds actually get distributed. The chimps eat them, and then they carry them off and deposit them somewhere else. And but what was fascinating about that is just how literally dependent we are on animals in the whole chain to make a forest grow and take seed. So you can say more about that if you'd like.
Well, I'll take it in a different direction. It's also about poop. And... that's why I carry cow with me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we all know that cutting down a forest means that you release CO2 into the environment from the trees, but also from the forest soils. And yet, as new middle classes emerge, particularly in Asia and Latin America too, I suppose, more and more people around the world are eating more and more meat. More and more people are believing you have to eat meat several times a day to be healthy. Actually, the opposite's true, but never mind about that. But anyway, as more and more animals are raised, so more and more digestive systems are working, and this is releasing methane gas. We do it too. And methane is a much more vicious substance in the greenhouse gases than even CO2. And a huge proportion of these greenhouse gases comes from methane, not all from animals. Well, what can we talk about? Farting? I mean, I don't know what the polite word is. Breaking wind, perhaps. I don't know. Anyway, you all know exactly what I mean. And so not only that, but as animals are needed more and more for meat, so huge areas of forest are cut down every year to provide space for growing grain to feed them or to graze cattle and goats. And so the added CO2 into the atmosphere from just eating meat. So even if you don't care about the torture of the animals, and I don't know how many of you have been into an abattoir or seen into a battery chicken, but if you do, it'll perhaps make you feel as I felt when I had learned about these things. The next time I saw a piece of meat on my plate, I thought, this symbolizes fear, pain, and death. And then on top of that, I learned about all these environmental impacts as well, and those to human health. All the antibiotics that are used to keep them alive, which are getting out into the environment, and the bacteria are building up resistance. People have already died from a scratch on a finger because there isn't an antibiotic strong enough. And talk to people in the health business and they'll say they really fear a new pandemic, and the main reason these antibiotics are losing their power is because they're just used to keep animals alive.
Thank you for that. I you have another friend with you as well as the cow. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Mr. H is changing the subject a bit, perhaps more like the end of the book, where we talk about, you know, the resilience. Mm-hmm. But Mr. H is just an individual. You probably saw him in the video back there. He's been with me for 26 years, given to me by a man who went blind when he was 21, decided to be a magician, was told it was impossible, said he'd try. You wouldn't know he was blind if he was up here now. And he gives shows for children, and then he'll say to them, you know, things may go wrong in your life, but if they do, never give up. There's always a way forward. And he does, climbs mountains. He does skydiving. You know, I think it's crazy to jump out of a plane anyway. But to jump out if you're totally blind is the height of inanity. But anyway, he does it. And his name is Gary Horn, so this is Mr. H, and when you touch him, the inspiration rubs off.
You mentioned Brazil and what has been going on there, and I thought about, makes me think about the crops of cocoa and other things that are being harvested for cocaine. Can you talk a little bit about what that's doing to us? Not just the Coca-Cola company, I would never cross the Coca-Cola company, but.
Okay, so you want to know about the cocoa plants?
Or? Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I had to take away with this that I'm going to say may not be the direction that you want to go, but what I was really struck by is that how we vilify plants. And so we take a beautiful indigenous plant that has all kinds of healing properties for, and is very revered in its home country, in its home history, and then we turn it into something like cocaine and create a huge cartel business around that, causing a lot of, drug wars and damage, etc. And somehow that gets blamed on the plant, and that was one of the things that I was most impressed by as we did the research and writing that whole chapter about plants that are used for drugs, is that the plants themselves often have these beautiful medicinal sacred histories, and that we've turned them into something destructive, and then we go about, you know, slaughtering the plants and throwing
And killing them in response to, you know, the cocaine problem. So.
Thank you. In your book, there are some beautiful quotes, and one of my favorites sort of follows that. It was in the part about the canopy, and it said, I'm not sure who said it, but it says, if a work of man is destroyed, it's called vandalism. But if a work of nature is destroyed, it's often called progress. And as we get toward the end of the book and you talk about those three wonderful trees, I feel a little guilty in bringing this up because I don't want to give away the ending, except that there is a tree that survived 9/11, and it's the most beautiful story. It did make me cry. I don't want to make the audience cry, but Dr. Goodall, could you talk about it a little bit?
Well, when I heard about this story, I was moved. It was there are various people involved. I won't go into all their names. You can find it out in the book. But after 9/11, I was in New York for 9/11, so it was kind of very meaningful for me. And they found when they were clearing up and, you know, trying to bring back order, they found this stump of a tree. And it was the only bit of tree they found. And it was on a truck going off to be, you know, ground up or going off with the other rubbish. And one person saw it and thought, this tree is still alive. It's got one live root and I think one or two branches. So we have to try and save it if it's managed to survive when nothing else has. Anyhow, they took it to a botanic gardens and they nurtured it. And it had various mishaps. It nearly died in a gale, hurricane, whatever it was. And finally, it's now gone back to 9/11. You can go and visit Survivor. And the people organizing the garden wanted to cut it down and throw it away because they said, this is the only tree that doesn't fit our pattern. We don't want this pear tree. When they put, I can't remember the other kind of tree they put, but there was such an outcry. And people go and visit Survivor, and I've been to visit Survivor, and it's a very moving experience indeed, especially to meet the people who looked after it. And it's all in the book.
Thank you so much. There's a beautiful pictures of Survivor in the book that you'll find when you have the chance to sit down with this amazing work. I would like to welcome the audience to ask questions, and our student volunteers have microphones. They're going to be on both sides of the hall, and so if you have a question for Dr. Goodall or for Ms. Hudson, if you'd raise your hand, we'll try to get as many in as we can.
How did you get into North Korea, and what happened?
Good question.
It actually came about through one of the very few NGOs that exist in North Korea. And I have a friend in Beijing who's German, married to a Chinese, and she's been working with horticulturists in North Korea to try and help the people in their famine by working with farmers to help them increase their crops by introducing urban farming and things like that. And they were the ones who invited me. It wasn't a government invitation. And I'd been twice, and the woman who was translating, you know, she obviously works for the government, and afterwards she said, you know, Jane, I've translated for almost all the foreign visitors who come over here. You're the only one that hasn't been asked for a transcript before you make a speech. And she said, it's extraordinary. So if you go to North Korea now, there are two books translated from English into North Korean, three books. And one of those is Thomas Hardy. It's a diatribe against the upper classes. And two of them are mine.
Is there a question on the other side?
I'm so honored to be here. And I'm a lover of plants. And without plants, we cannot survive. And I'm so thankful that there's a person like you who is defending our plants. Yesterday, it was very exciting to hear that there is a machine that has been developed, that it's a computerized machine that is hooked up to the leaf of a plant and the root of that plant, and you can actually hear the music that is generating from that plant. And I was wondering if you know anything about that, or you've heard anything of that. I heard it on KPFA yesterday on the Herbal Highway.
So I actually don't know, you know, the research science about it. It makes sense to me. I've had an experience where I've seen that first person in a small community in northern Italy called Domenher, and it was a big part of their research there, and they actually have recordings of the plants. I don't know the science about it, but I've heard it, and I know the music that they've shared is beautiful.
And I think that's a point to say that, you know, there was so much for this book that couldn't fit in. We have masses of it, stories, beautiful stories. So we are doing a blog, and we will be updating it with stories. And this is just the kind of thing that we might find out and add in, because, you know, this whole research on the way that trees can communicate by releasing pheromone-like chemicals. So if they're attacked by a swarm of caterpillars, then they put out these pheromones, and neighboring trees of that species can put extra toxins in the leaves to protect against the probably arriving swarm when those caterpillars, hatch. And they also, some plants can communicate through the microfungi of the roots, and they think in some cases whole forests may be linked underground and sharing food with each other and sharing information. So we have so much to learn about them, and I really hope this can be an ongoing way of sharing information from around the world.
Thank you. I think we have a question in the balcony.
Hi. It's an honor to be here. I just want to say thank you for inspiring me to pursue a career in science. I have a personal question that I think has global relevance. Back to the cow, I am a fan for what you were talking about as far as the environmental purposes. And I was wondering what you'd recommend to someone going out into the world trying to solve this problem. What do you think the best remedy would be as far as decreasing the environmental impact of food production?
Can you give us the question again? None of us quite grabbed it.
There's a horrible echo here. It's very hard to hear.
Sorry. Yes. I was wondering, you mentioned with the production of animals on these large factory farms that they're releasing methane and causing a lot of negative environmental impact. And I was wondering what you would recommend that we do as a society to try to solve this problem.
Oh, it's easy. You stop eating meat. At the very least, you eat less meat. And you know, I'll tell you something really interesting, and that is that we have the gut of a herbivore. The herbivore has a long, I can't remember the piece of the gut, it's very long, because they want to get the maximum goodness out of the leaves and grass and stuff that they're eating. The carnivore has a short piece of gut, that particular piece of gut, because they want to get rid of the meat quickly before it starts rotting in the gut. We have a herbivore gut. Maybe this is why we have a lot of digestive problems. All I can say is when I stopped eating meat, I felt so much better. I don't think aged 80 I could be traveling 300 days a year around the world, giving lectures, everywhere, if I was still eating meat. I'm pretty sure I couldn't.
And do we have a question on this side?
What?
Have the house lights up a bit.
Yes, can we get the lights into the auditorium so that we can see who's talking?
Yeah.
Thank you. Go ahead, though, while they're working on it.
What was your relationship with the chimpanzees, and how did it feel trying to incorporate your love of animals with your environmental work?
Well, the relationship I had with the chimpanzees was to build up a relationship of trust. So they knew I wasn't going to harm them, and we can wander around among them without being harmed ourselves. And one of the most important things is to work with the people living around the forest where chimpanzees or any other animals are living, and help them to understand and find ways of living in harmony. So because we've worked with the people living around Gombe and improved their lives in many, many different ways, from farming, microcredit, education, health, and so forth, they're now our partners in conservation. They are protecting the forest. They're putting land aside so that trees can regenerate around the tiny Gombe National Park. And as a result, 10 years after this program began, the chimps have 3 times more forest than they had 10 years ago. And so it's when you get the goodwill of the local people, and they're your partners, and that is the only way for conservation to work anywhere, even in an industrialized country. If you don't have the people living on the ground behind you, then conservation isn't going to work. You know, I go every spring to Nebraska with Tom Mangelson, the wildlife photographer, who's down here clicking away somewhere, along with Ron Hengler, who's another photographer who I meet every time I come to California. He's over there. So I go to Nebraska, and there the cranes are feeding on the leftover corn after the harvest. And because farmers are struggling, they've been cutting down right up to the very edges, they've been draining the wetlands, and it's becoming a more difficult environment for the cranes. So we've been having meetings with the farmers to see how they can benefit from the cranes, and it's beginning to work. So as tourists go, the farmers get more benefits, and they're more prepared to leave the remains of the corn lying on the ground and not plow it back into the soil.
Do we have a question on this side?
Hello. I have 2 questions. Just one? Oh. Well, they're combined. How about that? I saw you, I didn't see you, but I watched a video do a TED Talk, and you did a chimpanzee call. I was wondering if you could do one for us. And I also wanted to know if you could talk about your experiences being accepted into a chimpanzee group, if you would like to talk about that.
Well, I will close, I promise. I'll close with a chimpanzee call. I won't do it now, but I will do it at the end, okay? When I say accepted into their community, now Diane Fossey with the gorillas, she would sit on the alpha male's lap and she would make their sounds back and forth to them. I never wanted to do that. So what I wanted was to get the chimpanzees so unafraid of me that I would be just part of the environment. And that's what's happened. Over the years, there's a very strong research team at Gombe now. And it's very small because it's such a tiny national park. But the chimpanzees don't notice us. I mean, sometimes the infants will come up and want to poke you and, you know, touch you and things like that. And sometimes the big males want to vent their frustration on you and charge at you and hit you. But apart from that, we are ignored.
Thank you. Is there a question on this side?
Thanks. How many chimpanzees do you have on your island?
How do I get a chimpanzee what?
How many chimpanzees do you have on the island?
On the island.
On the island. Oh, the island.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well, these are the orphan chimpanzees whose mothers have been shot as part of the bushmeat trade, the commercial hunting of wild animals for food. and sanctuary in the Republic of Congo, the Chimpunga sanctuary, because it's the sort of heart of the bushmeat trade there in the Congo Basin. We have 160 plus chimpanzees, many of them fully grown, and they can be dangerous. They're very, very intelligent. They can find ways of shorting the electric fence so that they can escape. And this is extremely dangerous. So it was a big relief when the Congolese government let us use three big islands. We hope to put many of the chimpanzees out there. And right now, on the biggest of the island, there are 15 chimpanzees already. We're still working on the infrastructure, building a dormitory. We hope they sleep in there at night, because although the island's big with lots of vegetation, if you have lots of chimpanzees out, even in a big space, they start bending over the branches to make nests, and that's a bit destructive, because normally they just travel, you know, in big distances. So there's 15 chimps on there now. We hope to have two groups of 30 on that one island. And it's very, very expensive. And so the really good news is, you know, being 80, which my birthday yesterday isn't really particularly exciting for me. No, but but we did a fundraiser. Some of you may know of Wildlife Conservation Network with Charlie Knowles. Some of you may have been there. If you haven't, try and go later this year. And I've been going to Charlie's things every other year for 12 years now. And so he decided he would put on a fundraising gala for my birthday yesterday, and we made $1 million.
I have one more question right up front, please. Could you come up front, please? I know we all have questions.
Jane, this question came to me in listening to you speak. So much of your work is teaching. And I'd like to know if you ever saw when you did see yourself in that role, because you are a world teacher to the rest of the world. And without you, so much of this knowledge would not be growing and expanding, and not only teaching the young, but every generation, with hopes that it will continue. When did you see yourself as a teacher?
Well, I think my life has been so strange, really, in these different phases, you know, the research and then realizing I had to leave the forest to try and save it, not quite knowing what I should do. And finding, you know, I think in life one is given certain gifts, and some of the gifts that were given to me enabled me to do what I did in the field. Like, you know, I've got a pretty tough constitution, although I need it more now than I did in the forest, quite honestly. And that's part of that's genetic, probably inherited from my father. Patience I was born with. I'm sure you read the story how I hid in a hen house. It was in the little book you mentioned, Me, Jane. 4 hours when I was 4 years old, that's quite patient for a child. And then the two gifts that are most important to me now is, well, it's one really, one gift, communication. Whether it's by the word, written word, and I love writing, or whether it's by speaking. When I first had to speak to an audience, I was so terrified. I actually sat in Gombe and wished I'd be gored by a buffalo, anything, so that I didn't have to face an audience. But, you know, right from the beginning, I found that, yes, I seem to be able to have an impact. So I have really worked to develop the gifts that I have. And, you know, it was fabulous finding somebody like Gail, because although I love writing, and although I think this particular book, you know, is a very special book, so was the last one, Hope for Animals and Their World, which Gail helped with. What was the other one? Reason for Hope. No, Harvest for Hope. Gail's helped on all those three. And, you know, I I couldn't have done these books without someone like Gail, because I just don't have the time when I'm 300 days a year on the road, and I can only write when I'm back in England. So I suppose, to answer your question, it just came gradually. And the books, well, of course, the National Geographic played a huge role with their documentaries and magazine articles. But the fascinating and awesome thing for me is, well, somebody asked about North Korea. How did they know about me there? But they did. And it doesn't matter where I go now. Wherever I go, people have heard of me. Biologists say I went into biology or botany or veterinary medicine or zoology or whatever it is because of you and because I read your books. And, you know, it's quite extraordinary. And so even in this audience, there are two people in this space who come from a country where we now have another Jane Goodall Institute, where we're developing roots and shoots, we're trying to help in conservation, and that's Argentina. So we have Susana Patero and Susana Name. Susana Name is traveling with me, trying to make these lecture tours work. Mary Lewis, who's been doing this for a very, very long time. Jacob Peterson, who's really gets the things organized. He comes ahead of us. He has a terrible job, but he does it really well. And so all of these people are the people who make it possible for me to do what you're saying, teaching, and I'm saying communicating, sharing, and telling stories. Because isn't it true that it's telling stories that enables us to get our message across? And, you know, Gail's been fabulous in saying, Jane, you need your voice in here. You need that story. And anyway, we pulled it off, I think.
Happy birthday. Day to you. Happy birthday, dear Jane. Happy birthday to you.
Before I blow out the candles, first of all, thank you. That was wonderful, having this cake, and I will blow the candles in a minute. But I promised a chimpanzee call, and chimpanzees would enjoy this cake. And the greeting that you asked for, but the cake sound would be, come here.
Thank you all for being part of this today, and I wouldn't be a good bookseller if I didn't tell you that we have some extra books signed by Dr. Goodall that you can buy on your way out. I know each of you got one with your ticket, so you probably need another one. Thanks.
This is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. You just listened to the Institute for Leadership Studies, in partnership with the Book Passage, presenting Jane Goodall, Seeds of Hope, Wisdom, and Wonder from the World of Plants, here on radio.dominican.edu. Thanks for listening.